This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, is away this week. Coming up, a Supreme Court decision soon on the most unpopular parts of Obama's health insurance legislation. A petition to end impunity for Rwanda's role in the death of 6 million Congolese. And what happens when a mass movement becomes trapped in the crooked game of U.S. electoral politics. But first, President Obama's campaign managers have tailored a radio message made especially for black voters. The commercial features a chorus assuring the president, "We got your back." In Hartford, Connecticut, we spoke with Trinity College sociology professor Johnny Williams. He says the Obama campaign has its message backwards.
Having served in the military for 15 years, I know that when one says, "I've got your six," it means I got your back. And that you got my back, too. So it's a reciprocal kind of relationship. Given the policies that Obama has basically supported, which are very scant, there's been very little that he's done directly for, say, black people to show us that he has our back. So it means that we're all in it together. But he hasn't demonstrated that, at least policy-wise, when it comes to his policies, there's no "I've got your back" in that.
Well, you're a professor of sociology, and there seems to be some kind of sociological statement here. We've noticed for the last number of years that in many black conversations about Obama, the conversation's not about what Obama has done, his policies, his legislation, but how Obama is doing. That is, what are his chances, and what can black folks do to help his fortunes?
From my perspective as a sociologist who's a critical sociologist, as one who look at the situation in a critical way, assessing what is going on and what's not going on, I would say that that's not the way one would want to go if one is a pillar of the Obama support system. I mean, black people are a pillar of his support system, but they have not been critical, but they have been very supportive. That is, I think the numbers are down to 88%. It wasn't at 90 percentile some months ago, but I think now it's about 88% black support. So it's just been steady, hasn't declined significantly. It's basically just uncritical support. One can critically support Obama, but a lot of people are not doing that. What people are saying is that if you attack Obama, then you attack the whole black community to some extent. And it creates this tension within the community itself. People who want to say, "Hey, look, but what has he done for us?" He hasn't done anything, basically, except for these small little steps. And he has this kind of universal approach. If I do this program right here, it'll help you. But he doesn't say that to people who are gay when he came out in support of gay marriage and so forth, but he says it to black people. He doesn't say it to Jewish folk, right, when they ask for their interests to be taken care of in the Middle East and so forth, but he says it to us. Why does he do that to us? And that's a critical question to raise as a sociologist. What's going on? Why is he taking us basically for granted?
And I guess an even larger question is, why do black folks tolerate it?
And it is true that racism is a big part of what's going on when it comes to Barack Obama. We got to be real about that. But, you know, Barack Obama shies away from anything dealing with racism. I remember back in 2008 when he was running for president that me and about 50 of my colleagues from around the world, we wrote a piece of, I mean, it was published in The Guardian Unlimited. The title of it was "Every Plank and Nail and Screw." It's an open letter to Barack Obama about his so-called race speech in Philadelphia. We told him that we would be interested in helping him to come up with a public policy dealing with end of the problem of systemic racism. But he has not offered any policy proposal to deal with issues of systemic racism. Instead, he cloaks it in these kinds of universalizing understandings, presence of the whole United States. But if he helped us, then it says something about him being partial to black people. But if he helped gay people, that doesn't mean that he's partial to gay people, that he's gay or something? I'm hesitant to say this, but it seems that he doesn't want to seem to basically embrace his black identity unless it's in an ad that's, from my perspective, I mean, "I got your back." You know, it's basically patronizing to us. I mean, he doesn't really have our back. He hasn't demonstrated through policies and practices that he has our back. I mean, and why do we accept it? Basically because of, you know, the fact that we think he's the first black president, and therefore we have to support him in allegiance and not say anything. But I think the better question is this one right here. Who's saying that we better support him, that is, and be uncritical? Who is that saying that? People like Al Sharpton? Al Sharpton basically goes on TV. Anybody who says anything against Obama, treasonous against Barack Obama and the black community.
It's not clear to many of us that President Obama acknowledges the existence of systemic racism. In his Philadelphia speech that you talked about, he in fact denied that racism was endemic in the United States.
And that was the crux of the open letter that we sent him. I sent it to his senatorial office as well as I sent it to Reverend Wright and so forth. And I was very much supportive of Reverend Wright. His understanding of systemic racism was right in line with research in sociology and the social sciences, period. That it's a systemic issue. It's not just an individual issue that Americans like to say it is. It's not individual. It's systemic. It's in every institution, the way we think, the way we organize our lives and so forth. So it's not, we're not living in a post-racial society. He shies away from that because he doesn't want to be seen by pretty much a racist society, a white racist society, as having anything to do with black people. But the funny thing about that is, if you're black, no matter what, in a racist society, they're going to see you as being black. So why not embrace it rather than run away from it? And gender identity as a positive thing rather than a negative thing. And that's what Obama seemed to be doing, is this kind of negativity. Now, you go to the NAACP and he did Al Green, he sung that song to show that, I identify. But those are like very superfluous kinds of things that he's doing that it has no substance to it at all when it comes to policy. And helping to get us out of this unemployment rut that we're in. We're not in a recession. We're in a Great Depression in the black community. In a housing crisis, I mean, there's a report that came out that the median wealth had dropped from $120,000 to $79,000. What do you think it is for black folks? It's pretty bad. It's worse than that. It's probably nil. We probably have no wealth at all. Maybe $100. You know, we're literally going from paycheck to paycheck, most of us.
In fact, half of black households do not have any wealth or have negative wealth.
Exactly. So the thing is, what is he doing to get rid of that stress of a loyal constituency? 88% of the support for Barack Obama. He got 96% of the vote in 2006. And he has delivered basically nothing. I mean, okay, people will say health care reform, that helped everybody. It is universalizing kind of thing that there are now 7 million insured black people. But the fact remains that if you don't have a job, you don't have health insurance. And then you're going to penalize people for the fact that they don't have health insurance if they don't have a job. That's the way the system works. So it's not helping us at all. If anything, it's harming us. We need a health care system that is a public health care system, a not-for-profit health care system. He hasn't offered the kind of substantive policy reforms that are necessary in order to lift African Americans out of the dire straits that we continue to exist in. We've been in basically a depression since the 1980s.
Even in those black conversations that do concern themselves with actual policy, there seems to be a built-in apology for the president. That is, an assumption that he has not done this and that for black folks because other forces won't let him.
That's an argument that I just can't buy into because it doesn't really deal with reality. The fact is that Obama has not pushed the limits of that boundary, if in fact he is encountering resistance for offering programs up or policies up that will address the plight of African American people as citizens of this country. I mean, I haven't seen anybody come up to him and say, oh, there you go, he's helping black people. I haven't seen that by the Republicans or anybody like that. It's just he's refusing to do so. You don't want to personalize this thing, but why is it that he's not doing that? I mean, you want to know. Don't you see the plight of a people, a citizen? These are Americans just like everybody else. Why aren't you helping to address that particular problem?
Why is it considered somehow mean-spirited in some black circles to demand accountability from this president for his own administration?
Well, you know, again, I mean, it's all conflated up in the lens through which they see the world. They think that this is a black president and he's the first one, so we have to walk gingerly and not be critical of him and tell people the missteps that he's taking. I mean, killing people with drones, this kind of like secrecy state that he's operating, national security state, he's holding more secrets than George W. Bush ever would have held. And the continuation of the suspension of habeas corpus and so forth, but nobody's questioned him on this. George Bush couldn't have gotten away with this stuff, but he can. Because black people are so silent about it. They're being very uncritical because they think it's all racialized. but their constituency, and they deserve to have the president work for them like the president is working for other constituencies throughout the country.
Professor Johnny Williams at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. Veteran movement journalist Arun Gupta, who co-founded the Occupy Wall Street Journal, recently published an article on Wisconsin's recall election. It's a look at how mass political mobilization that raised such high hopes among progressives was steered into electoral politics and ultimate defeat.
The big question is, how did you have this wonderfully dynamic mass movement that inspired millions of people around the country, where you had essentially the biggest ongoing labor rallies since the 1930s, get shunted into electoral politics? And it's a complicated issue because, on the one hand, I'm, like many people, am leery of the electoral path. As we've seen over decades, no matter how much energy is poured into the Democratic Party, and especially labor pours a phenomenal amount of money and resources into the Democratic Party, it just keeps going further and further right. At the same time, numerous people I talk to on the ground, observers in Wisconsin, they all said the same thing. It was like, look, you know, electoral politics were inevitable. The problem was that became the only path, that there wasn't also the pursuit of independent movement building, that there wasn't this other organizing going on, there wasn't direct action, there weren't job actions. So if we go back to February of 2011, when Walker introduces his budget repair bill, it, I don't want to say spontaneously, because of course these things are never spontaneous, but from the outside, it just suddenly erupts into these mass protests and a takeover of the Capitol building. And you have thousands of people coming out, then tens of thousands, and then finally over 100,000 people are repeatedly coming out to these mass demonstrations. And the reason it inspired people, because they were democratic, they were just incredibly lively, they were full of anger and outrage, but there were also, there was creativity, there was fun, there was jubilation. And people knew what the problem was. One of the slogans at these rallies was tax, tax, tax the rich. You know, that is what the issue is here, that if there's a budget crisis, this is not because of public workers. It's because the tax rates on the rich are some of the lowest they've been essentially since the Gilded Age, and corporations are paying some of the least taxes over the last 100 years as a percentage of the federal budget. So people knew what was going on, and they were acting outside of electoral politics, because that signified, here we have a real type of democratic uprising. One of the analysts I talked to, Matt Rothschild, he said, well, essentially what happened was a handful of labor leaders, and he emphasized, I'm talking just three, four, five people, along with some Democratic Party honchos, decided among themselves without any sort of consultation from the rank and file, or much less the huge crowd that were turning out, decided we're going to turn this into recall elections. Now, he does caution that if the crowd was polled, people would have supported recall elections, but it's what else wasn't done. There was no type of job action. Like he suggested, a rolling blue flu epidemic where workers in one occupation after another call in sick. People could have worked to contract on the minimum necessary. He talked to some Teamsters and suggested to them, hey, why don't you guys roll your truck down the highway at 40 miles an hour, three abreast, for a few days to show that labor has the power to stop capital? And their response was, we're not considering anything like that. So there were all these options on the table, but it got turned into the electoral approach. And what we've seen then over the last year or so, there have been three elections, one regularly scheduled election for the state Supreme Court, the recall of something like nine senators, six Republicans and three Democrats in August of 2011. Now, this most recent recall of Walker and four Republican senators. And the only positive thing that the progressive forces in labor can point to is they did flip the Senate. It's now under Democratic control, 17 to 16. But that's small consolation. The gutting of the collective bargaining for public sectors remains in place. The billions, and it is billions of dollars, in social spending remains in place. The savaging of environmental regulations. They're trying to push through these restrictive voter ID laws, the war on women. All these things remain in place. At most, what the Democrats might do, and the emphasis is on might, is to blunt some of Walker's most extreme assaults. Then, on the other side, what you have is an absolutely energized right. They were able to defeat the Democratic challenger by 7 points, despite everything that labor threw up against them. Walker's star has certainly risen. The Tea Party has a perception of being stronger than ever. The right is highly energized. And this just really bodes ill for Obama, the Democrats, labor, and progressives.
And what is no longer in place, of course, is a mass movement. How was it possible that four or five labor honchos, who are also Democratic honchos, could steer a mass movement solely into the electoral arena?
Here's the thing. I think one person I talked to, Alan Ruff, he's a former lecturer in U.S. history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He said, look, you know, outside of a strong left poll, that's what was going to happen, that we have to understand people's normative behavior, that they are deferential towards authority. They're deferential towards the police, towards union leaders, towards the Democratic Party. Over the last 50 years, what we've really seen is the destruction of historical memory within individuals and institutions of struggle unionism, of militancy, of these types of job actions, of this notion that labor is in fundamental opposition to capital. Part of the problem, Ruff argues, is that it's the Wisconsin idea. The Wisconsin idea gets celebrated a lot, this notion from the early 20th century that government should be about progressive social reforms, increasing popular democracy, transparency, and honesty. But it's also based on a fundamentally flawed principle that capital and labor, there's no conflict between them, that everything can be mediated. So you create this culture of deference. You create this notion that capital and labor are on the same side, essentially. And so people do not understand that this has dramatically changed and that capital doesn't need labor and that capital is trying to destroy organized labor. So I think, you know, we can't let the left off the hook either, that you need to have really creative dynamics, mass left movement that attracts a lot of people that can say, hey, we can do something different. The reason Wisconsin is so important, it is really a snapshot of the last century, that we can see the effect of how labor has become straitjacketed by the collective bargaining system, the result of the McCarthy era and the anti-communist witch hunts, you know, where the socialist communist anarchists did have bases in unions where they were able to organize the rank and file, to do these type of jobs and actions where people had the consciousness that labor is fundamentally in opposition to capitalism. And so absent all of that, this cannot be magically created overnight. But at the same time, I don't want to suggest that the electoral path is the only route. It's not. There is a lot of other things that could have been done, but people need to create their own independent bases of power outside of the Democratic Party and the outfits it controls, and it largely controls organized labor. This is the only way to create real opposition to these neoliberal policies that both the Democrats and Republicans pursue with a great zeal.
You note that the right is feeling very energized now. What is the state of morale among those elements that made up the broad coalition in Wisconsin?
I think people, one, they're exhausted. This has been going on for 16 months, and this is, of course, going to be greatly discouraging. I think the reality is for a lot of people, they're going to conclude that protest is a waste of time. I mean, we also need to remember that when you had those crowds of 100,000 people coming out in the cold and the snow in the winter of 2011, for many people, this was their first time that they ever protested. And so it can become too easy for them to conclude, well, that protest doesn't have any effect. Now, on the other hand, other people may conclude, well, it's electoral politics that are a problem, at least the purely electoral approach, and that, again, we need to build these other bases of power. But it takes a left to be able to be there, to reach these people, to communicate with them, to give them a home, you know, not just an intellectual home, but a cultural and a social home. I think Wisconsin Uprising leaves a huge reservoir of hope, as does the Occupy movement. But I think for both of these movements, despite all their potential, they have been faltering because of three interrelated issues: a lack of organization, a lack of discipline, and a lack of strategy. And that is, I think, really, from my perspective, I would argue, one of the biggest issue going forward. How do you create the organization and then the discipline to come up with a strategy, to think through a real political strategy, and then to put it in place? The Occupy movement has been really ineffective in terms of doing that. It's more kind of this like chaotic militant impulse that comes in waves rather than any real thinking through of how do we confront these just tremendously powerful forces arrayed against us.
Journalist Arun Gupta speaking from New York. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to announce its decision any day now on the constitutionality of President Obama's health care legislation, especially its requirement that Americans purchase health insurance from private companies. That's called the individual mandate. Three major polls have shown the individual mandate is extremely unpopular with Democrats as well as Republicans. How might the Supreme Court decision impact the presidential race? We asked political analyst Paul Street.
The bill is really unpopular, I think, not just because of the mandate, but because it doesn't have what the preponderant majority of Americans have supported for years, maybe even decades, which is just a simple thing that people have always wanted, which is Canadian-style single-payer health insurance, where the government uses its taxing power, as it has full constitutional power to use, to raise revenue, to pay for health care, to pay doctors, to pay x-ray technicians, to pay labs, to take care of human beings and to take health care out of the realm of the marketplace and out of the world of commodities, like most of the world does. That's what most people, two-thirds of them for years, have called for. The thing that Obama pushed instead was this very bizarre plan to so-called universal coverage. It's not really universal because millions will still go uncovered. That leaves the private insurance mafia in full price-setting power, that leaves the drug corporate mafia intact with its own full price-setting power and all the pass, the costs that both of these mafias get to pass on to us to make us pay for their products. All those stay intact, and he gets to something approximating universal coverage by cutting a deal with the insurance corporations that all of us who have not yet privatized or do not have private insurance will be forced to purchase health insurance under the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. He's not relying on the taxing power to replace the insurance and drug companies that we all hate. He's using this Commerce Clause thing that's very controversial. We're going to compel people to buy a private commodity on the marketplace. People don't like that. It strikes many Americans as government intrusion. It's sort of odd. It's actually less government involvement than single payer would be, I would argue, within the healthcare system. But it's telling people that they have to go buy a commodity, and it's not clear that that's going to stand up constitutionally. I don't have a clear sense myself of whether it's constitutional or not. It's very clear that it's very unpopular with people. And the other thing to add to that is that most people have long supported what is completely constitutionally safe Look at Medicare and look at Medicaid. I mean, all you'd have to do for single payer was go into the Medicare bill and take out the clause that says that it's for people over 65 and just say it's for everybody.
And a recent Gallup poll showed that even majorities of Democrats believe that the individual mandate in Obama's legislation is unconstitutional. But none of this is an issue in this election year in the contention between these two political parties. And there was no challenge to Obama from the left in the Democratic Party.
This is what they wanted. And Obama, from the beginning, marginalized single payer. I mean, the venerable black Detroit Congressman John Conyers, who wrote the original single-payer bill, couldn't, in early 2009, even get an invitation to the healthcare summit, while Obama was confabbing in the summit and on the golf course, you know, with top pharmaceutical and insurance company executives, the black congressman John Conyers, and Obama's own so-called personal friend from Hyde Park, Chicago, the left-of-center doctor, Dr. Quentin Young, a longtime single-payer advocate, he couldn't get invited to the summit either. But Obama was so determined to serve his masters, his corporate masters, just to get his name, his legacy, hooked to something that he can call universal health care reform, that he's willing to go to the Supreme Court with a constitutionally ambiguous and questionable bill instead of going with what most Americans want, and which is completely constitutionally safe, which is improved Medicare for all, in other words, single payer.
President Obama's black support has diminished marginally. It's now in the upper 80s. But even that level of support doesn't seem to have any relationship to what President Obama has provided for black folks who have suffered so disproportionately since the collapse of Wall Street.
You know, you hear a lot about how the unemployment numbers aren't as bad as during the Great Depression. Well, yeah, except on Indian reservations, where there have always been wars in the Great Depression, and in some Latino neighborhoods, in particular in black community across the country, where we're looking at, you know, there's plenty of neighborhoods in Chicago with 40% to 50% real joblessness, if it was accurately compiled. They've got worse under Obama than any time in recent memory. I ran into an older African-American gentleman in downtown Iowa City the other day, and he had a T-shirt on. It said, Obama 2012, and we talk every once in a while, and I engaged him in conversation. I said, so Obama? He goes, yep. I said, has he done anything really for the people? And he just looked me in the eyes and said, absolutely nothing. Just like that. He just said it. That man has done absolutely nothing. But his comment came with this caveat, which he said, well, he wants to, but they won't let him. In other words, the congressional Republicans and all that. And I didn't go any further on that with him, but the truth is, I think that's a questionable assumption. Obama's been very clear, really from the beginning, and he said it explicitly when he's been called out about the worsening situation of black America. I mean, even the tepid Congressional Black Caucus had a mini-rebellion, I remember, at some point in 2009, where they wouldn't sign off on some Wall Street bill until he did something particularly or said something particularly about the black plight. And he just explicitly said, that's not what I'm here about. I'm not here to address the issues of any particular racial group. So he continues to run, as his political advisors tell him to do, from anything specifically for or about black Americans. And yeah, it's pretty chilling. And yet those numbers are through the roof. I guess that's how powerful, symbolically, the racial identity of who's sitting in the White House is.
As an example of what Obama could have done and that Republicans did not prevent him from doing, for 2 years, something like $6.7 billion of TARP funds specifically designated for the hardest hit neighborhoods in terms of housing just sat there unspent. Not one Republican prevented the administration from spending it. They chose not to spend it.
Right. The arch-racist plutocrat, white supremacist George W. Bush, had more to say about the issues of ex-offenders and their struggle for reintegration into the society, which is a huge and very underestimated issue, than Obama. And Obama knows all about this issue. I know he knows about it because he was put as a keynote speaker on a session to deal with a study that I wrote about it back in the years when I worked at the Chicago Urban League. He is intimately familiar with the prison question. And you don't hear so much as an inkling of an iota, of an amoeba, of a peep out of the White House about that issue, which is just fundamentally a critical issue in the black community. One of the saddest things about it of all is that Obama feeds a narrative in the white majority country, that racism is completely over in this country. And in that sense, makes racism more invisible than it ever was in the United States.
You wrote an article in which you pointed to Obama's claim that federal spending since he's been in office has risen to its slowest pace of any president in almost 60 years. He was basically bragging that the federal government is spending less money under him than under any president since or before Eisenhower.
The journalist I wrote about was a guy named Andy Taylor, and he said, well, it's not true. You know, Obama, this is the problem with Obama's rosy claim. That's what he called it, a rosy claim. That it's not true. And so, you know, this guy Taylor went through all these different numbers to get through, using particularly focusing on the Wall Street bailouts to show that actually Obama had increased some federal spending more than certain previous administrations, and so it really wasn't true. But, I mean, that's besides the point. The fact of the matter is that under Obama, we continue to live even more savagely than ever before in the neoliberal era, where the government spends money to bail out the very financial perpetrators who collapse and crush the domestic and the global economy, continues to spend more than $1 trillion a year on a military-industrial complex that murders rapaciously across the planet in the quest of U.S. control of increasingly scarce petroleum reserves, and can't spend anything remotely adequate to bail out the people that are suffering most from the capitalist economic crisis. That continues, and not only that, he's boasting about having a low level of social spending and a low level of social program spending. Like, it's a good thing. That's the real problem with Obama's so-called rosy claim, isn't it, whether it's factually, empirically, historically true, that this guy's got to get up there and talk about that, about low government spending, which is the absolute last thing the government ought to be doing, is cutting spending, particularly social spending, during an economic crisis and a recession.
And so with two austerity candidates and two war-making candidates, how can the people win?
You know, we started to get a sense of how we can win and what it's about in Madison, Wisconsin, I think, in February, March 2011. And in Zuccotti Park, and then almost instantaneously across more than 1,000 Occupy locations in this country, you know, we started to get it. As the great Howard Zinn used to say, you know, the most important thing, the most crucial thing we could remember is that it's not about who's sitting in the White House. Now, I would add, after Wisconsin, who's sitting in the governor's mansion. It's who's sitting in the streets, who's sitting in the workplaces, who's sitting in the cafeterias, who's occupying, who's resisting, and who's engaging in a real, direct social movement, street politics, beneath and beyond these big money, big media, corporate-crafted, candidate-centered, major party, electoral extravaganzas, you know, that the masters stage for us every 4 years, full of drama, telling us, you know, that's politics. That's the only politics that matters. No. There's the type of politics that built the industrial workers movement in the 1930s and the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s and the women's movement in the 60s and 70s and the anti-war movement in the 60s. And that shit is hard work day to day, beneath and beyond elections. Whatever happens on that big first Tuesday in November every 4 years, you know. And the left gets caught up in all these arguments and whether they ought to vote for the lesser evil, or if there's strategic reasons they ought to vote for the Democrat, or are they to boycott the election or ignore the election. I've even known leftists who've made arguments for why you ought to vote Republican. At the end of the day, big money is going to influence, above all, and big media too, which is part of big money, is going to influence who prevailed in that election. It's really outside our sphere of influence. There ain't much we're really going to do about that. What does matter, and what we can do and what we can focus on, and the only thing to make any difference, is the building and the expansion of social movements beneath and beyond that stuff. So now I don't even get in the debates about what to do with the election. You know, vote for a third party, boycott, ignore it. I don't care. Do what you want. That's your business. I'm going to be focused on trying to build social movements out here that might make a difference and save humanity.
Paul Street is author of The Empire's New Clothes, Barack Obama and the Real World of Power. A United Nations report charges that Rwanda continues to sponsor much of the violence that has killed 6 million Congolese since 1996, the biggest genocide since World War II. Rwanda is a close military ally of the United States, which has allowed allowed the Rwandan regime to act with impunity. Friends of Congo is circulating a petition demanding that the United States obey its own laws and call a halt to Rwanda's atrocities. We spoke with Friends of Congo Executive Director Maurice Carney.
Since the middle of March, a number of reports from the United Nations and Human Rights Watch documented yet again Rwanda's role in destabilizing the Congo. So we're circulating a petition from friendsofthecongo.org that calls on the Obama administration to enforce its own law that states that any neighboring countries to the Congo that destabilizes the country can lose its aid from the United States. Since 1996, Rwanda has played a destabilizing role in the Congo, and they continue to get financial aid, intelligence, training, military equipment. So it seems that the more they destabilize the Congo, the more support they get from the United States, and we're calling for that to stop.
Both Rwanda and Uganda is also culpable in the mass deaths in Congo. Both of these regimes are steadfast allies of the United States, armed, as you explained, by the United States. So what is U.S. culpability in the genocide?
Oh, it's at the very least direct and certainly indirect. Since the Clinton administration, the United States have had a policy that they've dubbed Renaissance Leaders of Africa, where they've identified certain African leaders as the future of the African continent. Paul Kagame of Rwanda, for example, or Yoweri Museveni of Uganda, Meles Zenawi of Ethiopia. And there are three things at least that they have in common. One, they're either authoritarian or dictatorial regimes. Two, they've invaded another African country. And three, they have the blood of millions of Africans on their hands. Timothy Reed from the Harvard Kennedy School of Government published a report called Killing Them Softly, where he laid out how it is that United States and Great Britain, foreign aid to these countries, have aided them in destabilizing the Congo and resulted in the deaths of millions of Congolese.
What you're asking the United States to do, it is in fact obligated to do under U.S. law. And that law was co-sponsored by none other than Secretary of State Clinton when she was in the Senate and Barack Obama.
Yes, actually the law, the Democratic Republic of Congo Relief, Security, and Democracy Promotion Act, is the singular legislative achievement by Senator Obama. It's a law that he sponsored, that he got passed under the Bush administration and co-sponsored by Secretary of State Clinton. The main element of that law calls for the United States to withhold aid from neighboring countries of the Congo that destabilizes the country. And to this date, President Obama has not acted on that law to implement it or to hold U.S. allies accountable. And as stated before, he has just continued the Bush administration policy where they developed AFRICOM with Donald Rumsfeld, where those countries, Rwanda and Uganda in particular, benefit from the United States intelligence, military equipment, military training, financial aid, and even diplomatic and political cover in the international community so that the United Nations and other international body have a hard time holding Rwanda and Uganda accountable, even if the United States, Great Britain, choose not to hold them accountable.
Who benefits from the chaos and bloodshed in the eastern Congo?
Oh, certainly Western governments, certainly neighboring countries, Rwanda and Uganda, certainly multinational corporations. The Congo itself, there is a mine in the Congo that's on the U.S. top 20 protected sites from terrorism. And that mine is owned by a copper and cobalt mine, which is vital to the U.S. aeronautics and military industries. And it's owned by a U.S. corporation, Freeport-McMoRan, out of Arizona. So as long as Congo is destabilized, you have foreign governments, foreign corporations that will continue to benefit from the enormous wealth that exists in that country.
So the United States has designated a copper mine owned by Americans in Congo as a protected national U.S. national security site, but the people of Congo can't be protected.
Exactly. It's a remarkable irony, isn't it? The Financial Times of London reported in February, reporting really what WikiLeaks had unveiled, that the U.S. has a protected site in the Congo, but yet we have millions of people dying. Half of the people of the 6 million dead are children under the age of 5, and as you said, not being protected, in spite of the fact that you have 20,000 United Nations troops in the country. The Congolese civilian population continue to perish to this day. So it's a classic example, Congo is, of profit being prioritized over the people. In fact, we often say that Congo is the nexus where you have Naomi Klein's disaster capitalism, where profits are prioritized over the people.
And U.S. militarization of Africa continues apace. Last year, President Obama sent 100 special forces, at least that many, into Central Africa. And now we read that the United States plans to send a brigade of 3,000 U.S. troops into Africa next year.
This is really, Brother Glenn, a sad thing, because we see the increased militarization of the African continent. We were asked before President Obama got into office, what will his policy be towards Congo in particular and Africa in general? And we set a marker of the kind of policy that the president's going to have towards Africa will be whether or not he continued the Donald Rumsfeld, George Bush, Africa Command program. And true to historic U.S. foreign policy, where you have the Republicans and Democrats carrying out the same actions overseas, we saw that President Obama carried on with the AFRICOM program. And he's even escalated it to the point where he has sent 100 troops, and as you said, looking to roll out battalions on the African continent, all really in the pursuit of Africa's riches, especially in light of China's advancement, economic advancement on the continent. We see a situation where the United States cannot compete economically with the Chinese. Therefore, they compete based on their strength, which is military. So it's for that reason we see the 100 troops going into Central Africa to protect the U.S. Strategic and economic interests, ultimately. And for the same reason, we saw when NATO bombed Libya, it was the United States that led the bombing through the AFRICOM program, even though when the program came out, the administration tried to present to the world that it was a humanitarian project where you have U.S. soldiers are going to be digging wells. But as we've seen, they're doing more than digging wells. They're bombing Africans, sending troops in the heart of Africa. So we really need to stand up to challenge this increased militarization of the African continent in pursuit of her riches at the expense of the African people.
Maurice Carney, Executive Director of Friends of Congo. This year marks the 40th anniversary of the founding of the African People's Socialist Party, better known as the Uhuru Movement. Its chairman, Omali Yeshitela, spoke at the Uhuru Solidarity Movement's National Convention in Philadelphia. Yeshitela examined the historical connection between white supremacy and capitalism.
You cannot get rid of capitalism by participating with the host. You'll have to have, as an objective, overturning the damn system of capitalism itself. And key to that is ridding the parasite of its host. That's the key. That's the key. And to do that, we believe you have to be organized. And that's why we've organized. I want to just share this with you. I want to quote Hosea Jaffe. He wrote an interesting book called A History of Africa. And he talks about the impact of slavery and colonialism on the emergence of parasitic capitalism and the development of white self-consciousness and the white nation itself. I think that's really important because we perceive ourselves, you know, you can't measure yourself by yourself. Do you know what I mean? You can't just say how tall you are. If you're the only person in the joint, then you're as tall as you want to be, as short as you want to be. You can only tell you are short or tall by standing up next to somebody else and see how tall or how short they are. And so there's a self-consciousness that was achieved by white people in the world. I hope people understand I'm not talking racial talk now. What I'm trying to say is that there's a certain consciousness that emerged, and that white power defined itself as white power. It defined itself as white power in relationship to the rest of us, and particularly in relationship to Africa. It was its relationship to Africa and slavery and colonialism that gave birth to the white man. There was no white man before then. It was just Celts and Visigoths and Gauls and all these other people who were constantly and perennially at war with each other, who defined themselves primarily in relationship to each other. They didn't say, there's a white Celt guy over there, and there's a white Gaul over there, and there's a white... No, they're just Gauls, Celt, and etc. It's only after they discovered us and what could be stolen and looted from us that you begin to see a different kind of self-consciousness emerging in the white world. So groups of people, that was not even a Europe, up until the 17th century or so, groups of people who previously defined themselves in relationship to each other, now it becomes a lucrative relationship that is established through slavery and colonialism, that they all begin to enjoy, that they begin to define themselves in relationship to the rest of us. That's the self-consciousness of white people as self-conscious entities, as entities conscious of being white. That's where it comes from. Let me read Jose Jaffe. The reason this might be a difficult discussion is, first of all, because most of us just get together and say black and white, united fight. Or, you know, we're all in the same boat now. But we didn't just all get in the same boat. We were always all in the same boat. We were all in the same boat when we came from Africa, except I was down there in chains and vomit and filth, and you were up on top. It's not we just got in the same boat. There is a relationship here that I really am trying to explain. I'm really trying to introduce science into this discussion. I want you to understand what's happening in the world. I want you to understand why there are people who are in Afghanistan say, damn if you've taken anything we got now. And people are in Iraq. People are in Iran. People are in South America who are determined to overturn this relationship that they've had with imperial white power. Jose Jaffe, he said, before capitalist colonialism, there was no Europe. Only a collection of feudal, mercantile and tribal towns, farms, villages, discrete states and kingdoms vying and warring with each other. Just as in Africa, but on a different property basis, that of private property in the land. Europe then was neither a concept nor a reality. At most, a vague idea that Arabs, but not quote-unquote Europeans, had long ago of someplace northwest of Greece. As long as Europe remained isolated from the world, there was no Europe. When it became connected with and dependent on first Africa, then the Americas, and finally Asia, it began to become a reality and an idea. Only when Portuguese, Spanish, French, Italian, Dutch, English, German, Danish, and Swedish confronted and clashed with Africa, America, and Asia, did the need arise for them to consider themselves as a set, a whole, different from, hostile to, and eventually superior to Africans, Americans, Aboriginal, and Asians. Colonialism gave them a common interest. He said, this common interest, slaving, plantations, the world market, looting, precious metals, spices and territory, markets and sources of wealth, was also the source of their conflicts among themselves. From 1500 on, they had already started to quarrel and fight over the colonial booty, figuratively and literally. In these intra-European conflicts, Portugal and Spain had in time to give way to Holland and France, and these in the 18th century to Britain, while German hidden colonialists, Calvinists, Catholics, and Jews alike steadily garnered what they could of the booty without shedding their blood or losing their own property in the process. The scramble for Africa that led to the 1884-85 Berlin Conference had its roots in four centuries of struggles between the European powers for the divisions of Africa. Colonialism, the basis of European unity, was the basis also of its disunity. I want to just share one other little thing with you because I think it's interesting. The first form, he's talking about how Europe was born. Europe was born out of colonialism as the exploiting, oppressing, negating pole that tried always to destroy and now assimilate its opposite pole, the rest of the world. So we're looking at what's happening now with how Europe and the U.S. is moving in the rest of the world. It said Europe was born out of colonialism as an exploiting, oppressing, negating pole that tried always to destroy and assimilate its opposite pole, the rest of the world. The first form was that of primary accumulation from the 14th century to the 19th. The next was of regular accumulation with an internal momentum carried forward from the primary accumulation. With capitalism arose Europe, and with Europe, the myth of European civilization, a civilization based on African slavery, American plantations, Asian spices, precious metals from all three non-European continents, based too on Indian numerals, Arab algebra, astronomy, and navigation, and Chinese gunpowder, paper, and compasses. This non-European civilization was a narcissus-like admiration of its own conquests. The sword, gunfire, murder, rape, robbery, and slavery formed the real material basis for the idea of European superiority. It was out of this process that the very idea of a European man arose, an idea that did not exist even in etymology before the 17th century. Before the slave trade in Africa, there was neither a Europe nor a European. Finally, with the European arose the myth of European superiority and separate existence as a special species or race. There arose indeed the myth of race in general, unknown to mankind before. Even the word did not exist before the lingua franca of the Crusades. And the particular myth that there was a creature called a European, which implied from the beginning a so-called white man. Colonialism, especially in Africa, created the concept and ideology of race. Before capitalist colonialism, there were no races. Now, suddenly and increasingly, there were races. Once born, the myth grew into a reality. So here, I'm just trying to offer a material basis for the reality that we are confronted with, even for the ideas that's in the brains of the people. Now, why the war everywhere? Because Marx was correct when he said that capitalism required as a pedestal slavery pure and simple in the New World. And so we look at slavery, the so-called primitive accumulation. We look at the ripoff of all the world, which has meant all these resources have been going to Europe and to what we call North America. But even what we call North America is a part of what Marx would have called or should have called the primitive accumulation of capital that gave rise to capitalism in the first place. So now peoples around the world are struggling, taking back their resources. Of course, this crisis didn't just begin, but it really escalated with the Second Imperialist War. With the Second Imperialist War, where Europe was preoccupied so much with fighting among themselves, the political space began to develop of peoples around the world. National liberation movements began to spring forward in India and China, you know, and all around the world, people waging struggles against imperialism. That was the beginning of the deep crisis that happened. And of course, everybody knows that capitalism is characterized as this thing where you have booms and busts. They say that this is typical, characteristic of capitalism. But how does capitalism been able to save itself with busts in the past? Because it has always been able to transfer the burden for the crisis on Africans, people in the Americas and other places around the world. But today, the difference is that the crisis itself is being initiated by struggles outside, by struggles of people in South America. By the fact they can't just get the oil that they want to get on the terms they want to get it from Venezuela. By the fact that all the people in South America, no longer they were waiting, gleefully waiting for Fidel Castro to die, not anticipating that Venezuela would happen, and Bolivia would happen, Ecuador would happen. All these other places that places a severe stress on the ability of capitalist production to rely on these resources as it was before. And to simply get on the phone and say, Jose, this is what I want you to do. It doesn't work like that anymore. Doesn't work like that in the Americas. Doesn't work like that in the Middle East. People are taking back their own resources. That is the underbelly of the crisis, and they can't see it. So they talk about all this other stuff that's happening above it, but it's resting on this pedestal of expropriation of all this value from everybody else in the world. Even China, which was out of the equation for so long, India out of the equation, India, a colonial entity itself. China was characterized as a semi-colony itself, just areas of exploitation. Now, the stuff that they used to be able to get from Africa and take from Africa, China's growing and coming and get the same resources. Indians get the same resources. They're growing their own economy. That's one of the reasons Saddam Hussein had to die, because he was industrializing Iraq. And if they industrialize the Middle East, they can use their own oil, make their own cars, use their own oil. That's a fundamental contradiction. The parasite then no longer has access to this host that it relies on for success. You with me on that? So the real struggle is not to try to rescue imperialism. It's not to rescue it, not to say, okay, give me my 401ks, because the only way you can get your damn 401ks is for more exploitation of somebody else out in the world. The real struggle is to bring it down, bring imperialism down. That's the thing that equalizes the peoples around the world. Why should things just be wonderful for white people? Why in the hell should you have your student loan when Africans in Sierra Leone have a lifespan of 37 years? Why should that be the preoccupation of the world? Real human progress is being made by all of those people who are struggling against imperialism around the world. They might not be Marxists, socialists, or any of those other kinds of things, and they might not represent the final answer. But what they do represent is an attack on the pedestal upon which the whole capitalist edifice rests.
And that's it for this week's Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, returns next week. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.